Developing a Lifestyle of Prayer has been our 1986 Discipleship Week theme. And so we have been working on learning how to pray when we face the crises of life, that prayer not just be an occasional thing, but that prayer be our lifestyle, that we do it as the norm of our lives. Well, it was not the lifestyle of the Hebrew people of Exodus 16. Rather, when they faced their crises, they demonstrated a lifestyle of murmuring. Now, murmur, or murmuring, is an interesting word. People who analyze words and grammar and such tell us that that is an onomatopoetic word. That means it's a word that sounds like what it is. You hear something through your ear and you mimic it in those types of words, like buzz or hiss or onomatopoetic words. And so is murmur. It's kind of self-defined. It's a low, rumbling sound of conversation, of complaint and criticism and griping one person to another. And it became the mark of the Hebrew people throughout their wilderness journey. Crisis is another interesting word. I'm told that in Chinese, the word for crisis is a combination of two Chinese characters, both of which themselves are independent words. They are the words for danger and the word for opportunity. So when you take the Chinese character for danger and you take the Chinese character for opportunity and bring the two together, you have the word for crisis. And so a crisis is a dangerous opportunity. Well, the murmuring of the Hebrew people in their times of crisis brought about the lessons that we find here in Exodus 16, lessons that would be good for us to learn as well. Most of all, it is the lesson to cope with crisis without complaint. Ah, but how do you do that? How do world-class murmurers learn not to complain when their dangerous opportunities come? Well, let's look and see. First of all, we understand that life is a series of crises. A couple of years ago, someone asked me if I believe there really is such thing as a midlife crisis. And I said, well, the way I see it, all of life is one crisis after another. And there must be one that is exactly in the middle, so that must be the midlife crisis. Therefore, I guess I do believe in a midlife crisis. For the Hebrew people, there was a crisis that came at an interesting time. Exodus 16:1 says that they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. I need to interrupt long enough here to say it is only a coincidence that the proper name Sin also has another meaning in our English language, meaning transgression or iniquity. That is not what these people understood it to be at all. It's a proper name, and in Hebrew, the word sin is not the same as our word for sin, so don't think that it means something more than it really does. They came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. Now, to get the chronology of this, you have to look back for a moment to the 6th chapter, the 12th chapter in the 6th verse, to see there the mention that the eve of their departure from the land of Egypt was on the 14th day of the first month. It doesn't take a whole lot of smarts to figure out if the eve of the departure was the 14th day of the first month. They must have left on the 15th day of the first month. And here in Exodus 16:1, it is the 15th day of the second month. So 1 month has gone by. It so happens that 1 month, because they were on a lunar calendar, we are on a lunar calendar for February only this month. We have a 28-day month. That's the way all of their calendars were. That means it was 4 weeks. You know, 4 times 7 is 28. So they've been gone for 4 weeks. Now, in those 4 weeks, they had experienced 4 crises. First was the Passover crisis, when the destroyer, the angel of death, swept across the land of Egypt, taking the eldest in every family in death. Next came the army crisis, when the Hebrew people were jammed in between the Egyptian army and the Red Sea. Then came the water crisis, when they thought they were going to die of thirst at a place called Marah, where the waters were undrinkable. And here in Exodus 16 is the fourth crisis, the food crisis, that makes them wonder if they will die of hunger before they ever make it to the promised land. Four crises in 4 weeks, meaning that they were on the crisis a week plan, these Hebrew people, a plan that some of us know a lot about because we also have crises on a rather frequent basis. And we're not talking here about spilled milk or crumpled fender or occasional headache. We're talking about real crises, the kind of things that turn topsy-turvy your career or your marriage or your psychological and spiritual equilibrium, things that have to do with children and house and school and car and sin and doubt and all of this. And it may seem to you that life is but one crisis after another. And the only good thing about the next crisis is it takes your mind for a few minutes off of the last crisis because you've had to move on to whatever the current issue is. Well, if it seems that way to you, the reason it seems that way is because that is the way it is. Life is a series of crises. Now, maybe you got up this morning and said, had a lousy week, really down. I need to be encouraged, so I think I'm going to go to church today and get a little bit of encouragement. And you come and you sit down and this guy stands up there and says, all of life is one crisis after another. And you think to yourself, I could have figured that out in bed. I didn't need his help to analyze all that and to understand it. But it's true. It starts with the crisis of birth and it continues to the crisis of death. And in between is one long series of crises. But that doesn't mean it's bad. That's not necessarily negative. Nor is it pessimism. Because crises are dangerous opportunities. The question is not whether we have them. We've got them, whether we want them or not. The question is what we do with those crises. Dangerous opportunities. That's what it was with the Passover crisis. It was a dangerous opportunity to lose an oldest child or to experience a miracle of divine preservation. Or the army crisis. It was a dangerous opportunity to be shoved into the sea, return to captivity in Egypt, or experience a miracle from God where he would put dry land through the Reed Sea. Or the water crisis. It was a dangerous opportunity to die of thirst in the desert or to experience God's wonderful turning of bitter waters sweet. And the food crisis is a dangerous opportunity to starve in the desert or to be fed by the menu of heaven. Just as our job crisis is a dangerous opportunity. A dangerous opportunity to become pathetically bitter and destroyed, or to see God marvelously at work in an extraordinary way in your place of employment. And the marriage crisis is also a dangerous opportunity to see sacred vows shattered, or to see a sick marriage healed. And the children crises are dangerous opportunities to see our children themselves destroyed, eaten alive, or to have those crises become building blocks to shape and build their lives for the future. Understand that there is no escaping life's crises. They go on, one after another. They will be there whether we choose them to be there or not. Some people seek to escape them by switching jobs or changing marriages or altering circumstances, only to find out that most often the crisis that is there next is compounded by the change that has been made. There's no escaping the dangerous opportunities of life. Life is a series of crises, one a year, one a month, sometimes one a week, one a day, one an hour. Certainly see the danger, but don't fail to grab the opportunity. Life is a series of crises. Second, murmuring amidst crises is often criticism against God. These Hebrew people developed a murmuring mentality. Now, that's not to say there was not a legitimate base for their murmuring. Almost always, there is a legitimate base for murmuring and complaint. When murmuring and complaint spreads through a large group of people, seldom is it completely without cause. In this case, they were hungry. They were afraid they were going to die. Their options were extremely limited. They couldn't go back to Egypt. They couldn't make it to the promised land of Canaan. And all they had left to eat were their livestock. But they were shepherds. Shepherds who didn't want to kill their sheep. Shepherds who had staked their claim in faith that God would get them to the promised land, that there they would raise their herds. Shepherds that only as a last desperation move would kill the animals they had. So they had a legitimate base. And then someone started to gripe. Had to start with somebody. And then the griping and the grumbling spread from one person to another until eventually everyone was caught up in the rumble. How hard it is to stay positive when everyone else is negative. How difficult it is to keep one's mouth shut when everyone else is murmuring. Sinful human nature lends itself to murmuring. And so, like an epidemic, it infected and spread and destroyed. The same thing can happen to us. You can see it where you work. Everything can be going along just great until someone starts to murmur, to complain about the boss or the building or the working conditions or the level of pay. Perhaps legitimate criticisms, but there's that undercurrent of murmur that eventually spreads through the entire workforce and then kills morale and may even take the company down with it. It happens in churches where someone starts to gripe and complain about the sermon or about the music or about the building or the parking or the youth program or whatever the thing is of the current complaint. And it may be a legitimate complaint. But when it becomes murmuring, it spreads throughout an entire body until the movement of the Spirit of God is quenched. It becomes tragic. It can even happen on a smaller scale within a family. You know, in every relationship, wherever there are people together, husbands and wives and children, parents and grandparents, there is always some legitimate cause for complaint and criticism. None of us are so perfect as to escape that. But when we allow murmuring to infect our family relationships, we see that it begins to spread from parents to children and children to parents, often beyond a household to an extended family, until, like a terrible disease, it begins to take everyone down. So it was for those people of Israel. A murmuring mentality crippled the nation, just as it sometimes cripples modern Christians. It's a popular sin, but it's a deadly one. With it came exaggeration. So in verse 3, the people are quoted here as saying, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." When they sat by the flesh pots and ate bread to the full, I mean, that makes it sound like these slaves in Egypt, every day their major decision was between the old country buffet and Shakey's Bunch of Lunch. I mean, that is not the way slaves live. They don't sit around these huge pots of meat deciding who's going to pick out the next chop or wing. They don't have bread to the full. Slaves are pathetic people. They're abused people. Slaves, slave nations, look at it throughout history, are given the absolute minimum of all that they need, lest they become too strong, lest they become too much in control. They're manipulated through the shortages of food. They're desperate, desperate, hungry people. Hey, they've been gone a month, 4 weeks, and they've forgotten. They've forgotten that they were screaming out in agony to God for release and relief. They've forgotten how desperate they were in the pain, to the point that they have transposed these things in their mind, and they have changed the memory of pain to make it into pleasure. They had pathetically exaggerated the little bit of food that they had until it became a feast. And what they had done, as far as Moses and Aaron was concerned, I frankly have difficulty even calling exaggeration. An accusation saying that you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. That could not be farther from the truth. Moses and Aaron weren't trying to kill them. They weren't trying to starve them to death. Moses and Aaron were the ones who loved them, who led them, who helped them, who were delivering them from captivity. They were the best friends they possibly could have. But murmurers never take those things into consideration. Murmurers exaggerate. Murmurers lie. Murmurers twist the truth. It's the sinful reality of gossip and complaint and discontent. Do you think they knew they were doing it? My guess is that if we could send George Gallup from Princeton, New Jersey, with his poll back to the wilderness of sin on the Sinai in 1500 BC, and if he were to do a scientific poll going from tent to tent among the Hebrew people, asking how many of them were murmurers, my unscientific guess is that he would come up with none. Out of the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, he would find a grand total of zero. I doubt that any of them thought themselves to be murmurers. They thought themselves to be insightful. They thought themselves to be helpful. They saw themselves as realists, not as murmurers, not as complainers, not as gripers. Because you see, one of the aspects of the nature of murmuring is that it is self-deceptive. We don't think of ourselves in that way. We don't project ourselves in that manner. Murmuring amidst crisis is self-deceptive. It is more than bad news. It is a self-defeating sin. Now, Moses was the guy that was insightful in all of this. When he told the people in verse 8, "Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord." They usually are. It's often true that when we complain against other people, who we're really complaining against is God himself. We're reluctant to actually complain to God, although some people, in fact, do that. We're reluctant to go to God and say, "God, it's your fault that I have the employment mess that I have. If you had controlled the direction of the company, if you had gotten this guy out, if you had given better direction to the overall industry, I wouldn't be in the mess that I'm in." But we don't want to say that quite to God because we think that he's probably the only one that can fix our problem, and we wouldn't want to get him mad at us at this particular point. So instead, we switch and we murmur against other people. We're reluctant to go and say, "God, it's your fault that my marriage is in trouble and I'm having trouble getting along with my children. God, it's your fault that all of these difficulties have created the crisis that I cannot cope with. It's your fault that I didn't get the contract or the business is not going well." We don't want to say that, and so we find some other scapegoat that we direct our murmuring and complaining against. But the truth of it is that often it is God against whom we murmur. The Hebrew people were murmuring against God, the God who had saved them from slavery. They were murmuring against the God who had taken them on dry land across the Reed Sea. They were murmuring against the God who had saved them from death by thirst at Marah. They were murmuring against the God who had done all of these marvelous and historic things for them, and soon they had forgotten. How ugly was their murmur. You know, I kind of see myself in those Hebrews people. It's almost as if when I open the pages of the Bible to Exodus 16, it's kind of like an illuminated mirror. Because when crises come, I'm tempted to complain. When crises come, I'm tempted to blame other people. When crises come, I'm tempted to murmur against anyone who's in range. When in truth, I shouldn't be murmuring. I should be praying. What about you? Do you face the same temptation? Do you submit to the danger when you should be grabbing the opportunity? Do you murmur when instead you ought to have a lifestyle of prayer? Do you think we could learn? You and me. Do you think we could learn that when the crises come, it is time no longer to complain, but instead to pray and to trust God who has taken care of us in the past and so will take care of us in the future? Do you think we could resolve to live a different kind of lifestyle than we've lived in the past? Life is a series of crises. Murmuring amidst crisis is often criticism against God. And then third, that God answers our crises with promise and presence and provision. When God heard their murmuring, he gave them a promise in verse 4. "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may prove them, whether they will walk in my law or not. Bread from heaven? You've got to be kidding. Bread from heaven? Now, the Hebrews, that may be the way they say it. We have a neat little American English way of saying it. We don't say bread from heaven. We say pie in the sky. You've heard that expression. And both make about equal sense. Bread from heaven, pie in the sky. Hey, when you're hungry, you don't need a promise. When you're worried that your children might die in the night of starvation, you can't eat a promise. You can't feed a promise to your family. What's a promise worth anyway? Well, a promise is worth as much as the person who makes it. You know that if you have money owed to you and payments are to be made on the first of every month, that the piece of paper, the note that you have, isn't worth much at all. What really counts is the person who made that promise. It is the person who will deliver on the first of every month or not deliver on the first of the month. We give vows in wedding ceremonies, and one man commits to one woman and she back to him all of earthly endowment and love and fidelity for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. What do those vows mean? What are those promises worth? I'll tell you what they're worth. They're worth as much as the person is worth. If the person isn't worth much in keeping promises, then those words don't mean a thing. And if the person is worth something, then those words make the difference of a lifetime. God's promise isn't as good as gold. It's better. God's promise is as good as God. Pie in the sky, bread from heaven. If God says it, then he's good for it. Because God, his promises are as good as the person. And the person is as good as God himself. Now, before God blesses them with the fullness of his promise, he first blesses them with the presence of his person. In verse 9, the word to the Hebrew people is come. Come on. Come near to the Lord. And as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. Amazing. They had to interrupt the sentence and say it. Behold, look at that. The glory of God appeared to them. Meaning that God's presence was more important than God's provision of food. It was more important for them to see and to meet and to experience God than it was important for them to survive starvation in the desert. Do you think that we could ever learn that? Learn that in our crises. Do you think that we could ever learn that more important than our getting the job or getting the contract or getting health or getting married or getting a problem solved, more important than the provision of any of those things that we claim that we need, more important than any of them is the presence of God himself? That at the end of life, if it were a choice, it would be better to have met and to have known God than it would be to have survived the disease or have gotten over the difficulty or to make it through the trouble. You know, when you look at all the different chapter titles that commentators put into the Bible, and you come to the 16th chapter of Exodus, almost every Bible that you have has some notation at the top of the page. Mine has quail and manna. Quail and manna isn't what was important in Exodus 16. What was important in Exodus 16 was the presence of God. And that's what's important in our lives. The most important point of all is that there they met God. And so it ought to be for us in our crises, that we may draw near to him and experience his presence. But he also provided for them. Verses 13 to 15, we're told that in the evening quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning dew lay round about the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as hoarfrost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, It is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. Quail are migratory birds, and quail migrate back and forth between southern Europe and Arabia. The course of their migration, both in ancient days and in modern times as well, takes them across the Sinai Peninsula. Their flight is long and sometimes difficult. Therefore, those who observe these things say that they often fly low over the desert of the Sinai, and they also often stop and rest on the little mounds of the sand and the dirt. They are then, therefore, very easy to capture. You can either take a rock, if you can find one, and conk it on the head, or else, if you're quick enough, you can sneak up. And even if it wakes up and gets going, most quail, if you're in good enough shape, you can outrun and get. So the people, even to this day, in the Sinai Peninsula, consider it to be something of a delicacy. They either boil them or they sun-dry them, and so they get their quail. That's not to say that there's a totally human or naturalistic explanation to that which here occurred. Certainly, God controlled their migrations. Typically, they have a migration to Europe and they have a migration from Europe. These migrations take place just twice a year. But the provision of the quail was all year long, and it was for 40 years. So God supernaturally controlled their migrations and supernaturally multiplied their numbers so that they were sufficient for the entire nation to every single night have finger-licking good Sinai quail. And in addition to that, in the morning, they had this flaky stuff. And that's a little bit harder to figure out. Verse 30, which we get to in our study next week, says that the flaky stuff was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. The first day it came, some of these Hebrew people who were morning type persons, you know, the kind of people that come to 8:30 services rather than 11 o'clock services, they got up and they opened the tent flap, and the first guy walked out and there was all this white stuff, and he said, "Manna." And by the way, in Hebrew that means "what is it?" And the next guy that got up came out and he said, "Manna." And then there was a whole bunch of them standing around looking at this stuff saying, "Manna, manna, manna." And the late risers, when they opened their flaps, came out and everybody was saying, "Manna, manna, manna." And finally, they thought that was what it was supposed to be called. And it sort of caught on. And even to this day, we refer to it not by any name. It doesn't have a name. It's "what is it?" Manna. Interestingly, again, in the Sinai Peninsula, there are scale insects that take the sap from the tamarisk tree, and they excrete a white substance that is laid on the ground that fits pretty well the description that we have here in Exodus 16 of manna, or what is it? It's white in color, it's sweet in taste, it is nutritious in value. In fact, Arabs, Bedouin, who travel across the Sinai Peninsula in 1986, still eat it and still call it in Arabic either man or manna. Again, that is not to say that there is a totally natural explanation to what here happened. God somehow supernaturally provided in an amazing way that fed the needs of an entire nation of people for 40 years, so there was a sufficient supply and just a sufficient supply every single morning of every single week with the exception of Saturdays. And it wasn't available on Saturdays. Clearly God was involved. But what is most important is not where it came from or what it was. Maybe this is a good guess and maybe it isn't. But what is most important is that God kept his promise and he provided what they needed in their current crisis. Not in the way they expected. They didn't even know what it was. Not at the time that they wanted it. Not with the variety that I'm sure that they would have sought on their menu. Not with luxury or variety, but with a meeting of their need, just as he does for us in our crises. We would choose to have God's provision long, long in advance, years ahead, so that we would know for sure and could count on it, but he simply gives to us a promise instead of a provision. And when the crisis comes, he often gives to us himself rather than the provision. But then he finally gives his provision, sometimes at the last moment, sometimes not in any way that we would ever have expected, oft times not with luxury or in great number,
but adequate. He meets our needs. For those Hebrew people, there were some specific instructions that came with this provision of need. Verse 20, though, tells us that they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them. How sad. A miracle from God, a provision from heaven, and they turned their miracle into something that had an awful stench to it. What do you think's the matter with these people? I mean, don't you want to almost reach inside your Bible, stick your hand in there, and if you could, go back through the centuries and grab a few of them and just shake them and say, what's the matter with you anyway? Don't you know that God is doing these great things? Don't you know all the wonderful stuff that's happening to you? Won't you change your lifestyle anyway to trust God? Why don't you quit the murmuring and start praying? Why don't you quit the complaining and start praising? Yeah, well, we can't go back through the centuries and change the Hebrews, of course. In fact, have you tried to change anybody where you work? Or have you tried to change anybody in your family? Pretty hard to change much of anybody, isn't it? Except ourselves. We can't change them, but we can change us. We can choose a different lifestyle. We can choose whether or not we cope with crisis. We can choose to obey rather than rebel. We can choose to trust instead of doubt. We can choose to pray instead of murmur. Now tell me, what's your current crisis? Got one, don't you? Yeah, we all do. What are you going to do with it? How are you going to cope? Would you, with me, choose right now how you're going to respond to that crisis and so set the pace for responding to the rest of the crises that are going to come for the rest of life? To decide right now to go with God's promise and God's presence and God's provision, and not to complain or gripe, to button up our lips in that murmuring that spreads from one person to another, and rather to open our mouths heavenward in prayer to God. Let's bow our heads, and let's take a moment and try it right now. Talk to God about the current crisis that you're experiencing, and commit to Him. Commit to Him to renounce a lifestyle of murmuring and to go with a lifestyle of prayer.